You're listening to CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We're broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory in British Columbia. What does it take to create remarkable art? Let's find out with today's guest, Ran Ortner. Welcome to another episode of Question Everything, where we connect young leaders with experts in entrepreneurship, publishing, and design. I'm your host, Carly Sotis, and today I'm in the studio of Ran Ortner. Ran is a New York-based artist who is known for his incredible paintings of the ocean. His work has been commissioned by the Dutch government for the United Nations World Water Day, and his paintings Element No. 1 and Element No. 2 have been displayed in the lobby of 7 World Trade Center. In today's episode, Ran discusses his upbringing in rural Alaska and talks about how he struggled to find his place in the art world when he first moved to New York. We talk about his experiences as a motorcycle racer and surfer and how they've influenced his career as a painter. We also discuss the myths of natural talent and overnight success and how passion is a valuable and transferable skill. The first time I saw Ran's paintings, they truly took my breath away. So I'm excited to be in his studio today to discuss his work and creative process. Thank you so much for being with us today, Ran.
Very nice to be here.
Could you start by telling us how you began your career as a painter? I'm sure it was a long journey.
It has been a long journey, and it was not what I was initially drawn to. Young, I was really captivated by my bicycle. It was my wings, and I really saw my future as a motorcycle racer. And so I pursued that until an injury put an end to that at 20. So that was really a difficult moment because I'd spent my whole adolescence completely focused on this area. So it was time to make a transition. And it was difficult, but I saw art as something that I love the fact that it was something I could do over the arc of my life, that it wasn't like athletics where you just had to be, you know, at your absolute peak physically.
So when you were 20 and you found out that you couldn't do motorcycling anymore, that must have been really difficult. How long did it take for you to shift and say, okay, I need to move forward?
Well, I started the shift fairly quickly because I felt I was always under pressure because you have to be successful really young to get the right sponsorship, to get all that, and it's a young sport. So I always felt time ticking. So then when I realized I had to make a transition, I really felt time ticking because I feel like I'm late into the next thing. And I started in earnest with learning as much as I could. I didn't have a formal education, but I was reading, taking workshops, trying to learn. And I found that it obviously wasn't as thrilling as racing motorcycles. I didn't have the natural talent that I had from such a young age with that. And so I started looking at talent and what is talent and how and what skills are transferable. And I really realized that the passion is the thing that's transferable, that longing for something. And I was looking at creativity, and I thought, this is interesting. Is the creativity of a motorcycle racer, or the creativity of an artist, or the creativity of a mathematician, or a doctor, are these different? How does creativity differ from art or from the specific thing you're pursuing? And is it common in all these different pursuits? So that was something I started looking at and really studying, and that I grew a lot out of that exploration.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. I can imagine people look at your paintings and say, wow, you're so talented, and think that it's natural and that you maybe didn't work at it. Do you get frustrated by that mentality?
I love that idea. So I'm very happy with that illusion. I think that this is something you see over and over again, is that if you work really, really hard and with tremendous focus and real discernment, that you get to a place eventually where your work looks like, wow, someone's worked really hard. And for the viewer, it's kind of exhausting and laborious because they feel the struggle. But what's interesting is there's a threshold there, and you get past that, and you can actually get to a place where the final output has a quality of ease, which is fascinating, because I'll find paintings that I've just pulled my hair out and really struggled. And in the end, the painting looks so effortless, like it just fell off the back of a truck complete. And I'm like, well, I don't know where you came from, but thanks for visiting, you know? So, yeah, there's a strange relationship between the struggle and then what you actually get.
For sure. Do you remember the first painting you did and what that was like?
Yeah, I was always really interested visually. I was interested in how my motorcycles looked, how things were set up. And then I was, when I was, you know, 12 and 13, I was cutting motorcycle magazines apart and making collages and making posters for my walls in my bedroom. So I was always interested visually, and in my art classes, I was engaged. So I was fairly young, and my mother was a painter, so okay. I was around it.
And you grew up in rural Alaska. What brought you to New York?
Yeah, I did grow up in Alaska. I was born in San Francisco and lived there for the first, just south of San Francisco, in a small town right on the beach called Pacifica. And we moved to Alaska when I was 5 years of age. Yeah.
And what was growing up there like?
Cold.
Did you always want to stay there? Did you always want to be somewhere else?
I was captivated by the place. And it still lives in my bones. You know, it was such a big primary experience. But I did not want... I wanted that as an idea that you go to. I didn't want it to be my center. I realized that I wanted to be where there was more cultural exchange, where there was a bigger range of ideas, where there was real contrasting ideas. And in a small place, in a small community, you don't get that diversity of thinking.
I think that there's this idea that we always have to create something new and something different, and that art is about pushing the boundaries.
Yeah.
And your paintings are so simple in a way. They're so ordinary.
Yes.
And that's what makes them so beautiful. And how did you resist that pressure to push the boundaries?
Yeah, you know, you go through this stuff. I mean, we all do. It's interesting. Maturing as an artist and finding your voice. We all do that, regardless of what we do as a vocation. We're all trying to be fully the thing that we are, to find our own voice. So whether you're an artist or not, this applies, you know? And it becomes, you know, so you go through these processes that we all go through. There's certain points where you think, you know, I'm so passive. Where's my inner bull? It's time to, you know, attack this thing. I need daggers and razor blades and mud in my paintings. And so I would make very aggressive things for a while. And then I'd be looking at them and I'm like, oh, man, save the drama for your mama, you know? Let's look at something. You know, it's still waters that compels. It's that restraint where you feel tension. And so then I would make white work that I would go to a quieter, more zen kind of contemplative place. And then in the end, you know, there'd be a while there and I'd be like, what the hell? Are you asleep at the wheel? You know, get some, you know. And so you swing back, you know, you swing back and forth. What I love about this subject matter when I came to the ocean is that the ocean has such an overriding feeling of peril. It's so deep. It's so mysterious. It's a place where we can drown in very short order, and yet there's nothing more effervescent, more seductive, more kind of healing and nurturing. So it's really a kind of collision of opposites of how it registers for us emotionally. So I'm really interested in this emotional complexity. Mm-hmm. I want the paintings always to be a little bit terrible and a little bit wonderful at the same moment, and hopefully I can develop a rhythm between these sorts of energetics that feels like it's not, you know, too bitter or too sweet, but just like the stuff of life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that mysterious thing that we all navigate.
When you look at the ocean and are able to see every little drop of water that's coming out of the wave, how did you find that attention to detail?
Yeah, what's fascinating is that they're actually not that terribly detailed, because the brushes I use are the roughest brushes possible. It's pig hair, it's bristle hair, which is kind of a forked hair. It really picks up paint. And so there's a lot of texture, and the canvas I'm using is a number 4, almost like a carpet, does not hold detail well at all. But what's interesting is I can't paint water drops. I can't paint the specifics in a photorealist kind of way. But I'm not really interested in the photographic experience. I'm interested in what great painting can do. Mm-hmm. And I love great painting. And so I've been, you know, just mesmerized over and over again with the lush, rich, endless profound quality that you get looking at a Rembrandt or a Velasquez, or, you know, just these amazing masterpieces. And so my question for myself was, what do these paintings do? How do they work on us like this? And I know that the energy is so special, and the range of it is so, there's so much possibility in that range that we haven't begun to exploit it. There's, you know, worlds within worlds there. And so I'm really, you know, pulling from the old masters as far as the technique. And what's interesting about old master technique is it's a layering process. So you build your lights up and they get a bit chalky. And so then you glaze them down, which is basically like putting shoe polish or wood stain on. And then it gets a bit murky and heavy. And so then you put lights back in, and then it gets a bit chalky and blown out. And then you put the glazes back in, and it gets a bit murky. But each of the adjustments are a little more subtle. But what's interesting is in that layering process, you're actually trapping your effort and your time in those layers, and your emotional, the painting is kind of like a lie detector test. What you are, how you observe, and how you respond is all there. And it gets trapped in these layers over time. And that's really quite extraordinary, that human emotion is actually stored in these surfaces.
That is incredible. Mm-hmm. When you're doing so many layers, how long does a painting take you to do? And how do you know when it's complete?
Oh, man. They can take a couple years, a really big one. But, you know, I used to struggle with that when it was complete, because they're never quite enough. You're always falling short, you know. But they can really get to where they have something, and they can really have it. And you recognize that more and more as you gain experience. So that's nice. That's one of the great compensations for aging, is that you can gain a bit of mastery, or a bit of, you know, understanding of the practice that you're engaged in.
For a taste of the classics with a twist, join me, Marguerite, with Classical Chaos, Sunday mornings starting at 9, right here on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver, Canada.
You're listening to Question Everything on CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I'm your host, Carly Sotis, and joining us today is New York-based artist Ran Ortner. When you look at a canvas to start a painting, where does one even begin?
It's, you know, it's a canvas is an incredible thing. You know, you start it and you look at that white canvas and it's just like, it's a masterpiece. It just needs some assembly, you know, and you have endless possibility. And you put your first mark on that canvas and you no longer have endless possibility. You now have a problem. You have canvas with a mark on it. And so then you're kind of off to the races. You know, you're there and you're engaged, and it's the push and pull and that question of what does this painting need? What does this canvas need? It's that becomes very interesting, the sovereignty of the object and that, and responding and working with that.
What advice would you give to young people who look at the canvas of life, say, and say, it's so overwhelming? Where do I begin this big project or this big goal that I have?
I like to say that the best place to start is with your socks. And it's an interesting idea, is when you get up in the morning and you open your drawer that has your socks in it, you pick the pair of socks that you want to wear, that you feel like, right, these are going to suit me for today. And what happens when you do that, you're exercising these particular muscles, which are our capacity to intuit, our capacity to connect this particular thing. And when you look at a menu in a restaurant, it's the same. The more we can have our ear to the ground, to ourselves, to what feels specific to us, what personally resonates for us, I think that we grow through this continual exercise. Pygmies in the jungle live with thousands of paths through the jungle. And they have this idea of what path do you choose? And their notion is you choose the path with heart. In little ways, we do this constantly. And if we're doing this in little ways, that eventually it'll lead us in bigger ways. I mean, this is really Shakespeare's idea, to thy own self be true. And I think if we can truly, fully be that thing that we are, we're living our life in accord, you know, and that's a very high ideal to reach for.
Were you always striving for that higher self, or is that something that you developed?
Well, that's a good question. Is it a higher self, or is it a lower self? Mm-hmm. Is it really the most primary, basic thing that you are? I remember when I was first coming to New York, I thought, oh God, how am I going to take on, you know, I'm not connected. I don't come from a family that has a strong social network. I didn't come out of the Yale Arts program or Goldsmiths or any of the top schools. How am I going to make my way? And I was talking to a guy who in California who's kind of a mentor to me, someone I really respected. And I'm like, how am I going to do this? And he says, well, maybe you're just going to have to be some guy from Alaska. And I'm like, no, that'll never work. But in actual fact, it does. I mean, that we each have our particular imprint. We're the particular thing of our particular experience. And we just have to be, the way that I look at it is we just have to be, just say yes to that specific reality. But to your earlier question about how I chose the ocean, I really resisted the idea. I thought that it was a poor idea, that it was so been done. I thought I would be laughed out of the New York art world. They'd say, go back to California, pet a dolphin, rub a crystal, smoke some weed. You know, this is not the top tier of culture. And I was reading this book by a monk that I thought, and he was talking about novelty. And he said, there is nothing as tiresome, as kind of old and wearisome as human novelty. And there's nothing as new as that thing that's most ancient, always in the process of becoming. So I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. What the hell is he talking about? And I realized, no, that thing that is so ancient, always in the process of becoming, that's the push that's making grass grow. I see in the ocean, I see the ancient body of the sea, but each wave is like a metronome marking now. So I'm like, that becomes fascinating. Can I feel this deep root of time, this feeling of the ancient and the immediacy of the now in the very same moment? And so in the ocean, I really realized, wow, that would be fascinating to, now that I can see it conceptually, to explore that. So that's kind of how I arrived at that.
And you are a surfer as well?
Yes. Yeah.
So how has that affected your relationship with your paintings?
It's affected them dramatically. I don't think these paintings could be painted by a non-surfer. I think that surfers have a particular engagement with the ocean that is fairly novel. Sailors are always, you know, they reach for the horizon. There's this idea of the journey, where surfing isn't about transportation. It's a local experience. You're kind of in it, full immersion. And when you're paddling out through big waves, you're duck diving underneath them. You're getting rumbled by them. So you're really in physical confrontation with the ocean. And a lot of times it's beating you up and holding you underwater and, you know, depriving you of breath. And the next moment you have this incredible rhythm when you're on the face of a wave and really moving in sync with that larger energy. So paintings, I'm mind surfing, you know, I'm feeling the contours of the water. I'm very conscious not to paint the cliche surf wave. I do not paint perfect barreling waves. I want to paint more the excited surface. I want to paint this enlivened surface, this kind of electric, shimmering, dancing, mirroring surface. So it's actually very poor surf conditions that I'm actually painting, but my experience as a surfer really puts me in it.
You were talking before about the overlap between being a motorcycler and painting, surfing, and all those different things. Do you find similarities among all of them?
I do, dramatically so. I think in all of them, you have a kind of relationship with time. You have these moments of acceleration and deacceleration. And in all of them, you get in situations where there can be an enormous amount of complexity. And when there's the most demand, the most complexity that you're managing, it's really when you need to bring the most elegant solutions. In racing a motorcycle, if you try to go faster, you force yourself towards speed, the effort will congest your movements and you'll go slower. Your lap times will drop. But if you move with the idea of moving as elegantly as possible, to be as smooth as possible, speed is really a byproduct of elegance. And painting's the same thing. Once you're painting and you put one or two marks down, it's fairly straightforward. But after a while, the complexity, this thing comes to a boil. You're dealing with a lot. And it's looking for those elegant lyrical solutions that really, there's something that Joseph Campbell said about art. Something becomes art when it achieves a fortunate rhythm. So I think this fortunate rhythm is really at the root of all of these practices, racing a motorcycle, surfing, and painting, is this feeling for and this accord with a fortunate rhythm.
What is disability insurance? 1 out of 10 Canadians wouldn't know how to answer this question. What's more troubling is that 3 out of 4 Canadians say that being unable to work for 3 months due to a disability would severely impact their personal finances. But getting covered is easier than you think. It generally only costs between 1 and 3% of your income. And insurance benefits can maintain your income as though you're still at work full time. If you are a working person, then stay safe and get covered. Statistics courtesy of RBC Insurance.
Welcome back to Question Everything on CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Today we're speaking with New York-based artist Ran Ortner.
You must spend a lot of time in solitude. What do you think that one can learn about themselves? I feel like there's always a pressure to meet people and be doing something, but I think that there's also so much that can be learned through spending 12 hours a day with yourself in a painting.
Yeah, I think we always need all of the above. Mm-hmm. I think that's usually the answer to most things. But the poet Rilke expresses this idea. He said, "We must be much alone and gather honey." And that notion of to gather honey, to actually have something that we can then exchange when we meet in community. Mm-hmm. There was also something that Da Vinci said. He said, when you're with 4 other people, you are a quarter of who you are. When you're with another person, you're half of yourself. You're not truly sovereign until you're alone. So I think when you're alone, what's fascinating is it possible to lose that social mask, that idea of what our community expects from us, and truly be the thing that we are? What's amazing about solitude is that you very quickly encounter the enormous well of loneliness that each of us must encounter. Each of us lives in the sealed container of our body, and each of us must manage this kind of isolation. And yet at the same time, we are deeply social. We need to connect. And that's why I love culture is all about this, you know, about this kind of connection. But we connect from our specific islands of our individuality. And so that's quite fascinating, the rhythm of that. Mm-hmm. Again, trying to find this fortunate rhythm between who we are in our individuality and who we are as part of our community.
How do you balance that time with your craft and now with marketing and all the other things that come with business and being an artist?
I don't. I'm a lot of things, but I don't think anyone would ever accuse me of being balanced.
I was going to ask about you won the first art prize competition, which is awarded by popular vote, and there was something like 300,000 votes, and your painting came top place. How did that make you feel as an artist to have your work received like that?
It was a strange experience and a just incredibly beautiful experience. I was, I had turned 50 years old. I had been living illegally in industrial space, painting for years. I was, you know, I had enormous success within my studio, within my sense of where I was going. And I had a couple of collectors and friends, and I knew my work, there was something there. But I struggled every month to cover my bills. And when our prize happened, I didn't enter the competition myself. Someone entered it for me, saw it as an opportunity for me. And I was quite upset then when I was approached with the parameters of it, the first thing I thought that it was an internet scam. You know, it was someone just trying to, I didn't know what the motivation was, but I knew that the largest awards in the art world were the Turner Prize, which is $100,000, the Hugo Boss Award, which is around the same kind of cash prize, and this was $500,000, and so it just seemed like, no. But as one of the directors of the program reached out to me as kind of a social experiment, was to see what kind of energy it could bring to this town, to Grand Rapids in Michigan, and I just thought, wow, okay. Let's do this. And then it was just the outpouring of people. I forget the numbers on how many. I didn't expect that I would, place in the top 10. And then when I was told I'd made the top 10 and I went out there, I would stand in front of the painting, was watching, just thousands and thousands of people pour by the painting each day. And they had like 14,000 artists applied from all over the world, reduced it down to this 1,260, and then by public vote. And it was really staggering and beautiful. I was, at that point, I think I had borrowed $70 the week before to pay my phone bill. And then I won that award, and it was half a page in the New York Times.
And so, incredible.
Yeah, it's kind of an older, grumpy Cinderella, but Cinderella nonetheless. I would get 5 emails every couple of weeks, and after that I was getting 250 a day. So it's like you literally walk across a threshold, and I found it difficult to find this a new rhythm for my life. I had established my rhythm over a long period of time, and I can really see why so many people that have enormous success at 20 or, in their late teens through music or film or whatever, that it can be incredibly disorienting, because I found it disorienting. But it became very clear to me I needed to learn a new set of skills to accommodate this next chapter in my life. So I set about doing that, and I'm still doing that. I'm still building those skills.
What are some of those skills?
The skills, how to manage yourself socially, how to be engaged enough, how to understand. It's fascinating when one becomes a brand. At a certain point, we all have a kind of public mask. And, whether there's a week when 120,000 people look at my Facebook page or what is that? It actually has nothing to do with who we are personally when those kinds of things happening, but they make a lot of they can make a lot of demands on your time. So then again, it's then how do we make, sound choices? And I made a few that took a lot of energy that I wasn't happy with how they resolved. So it's like, that old thing, trial and error, and trying to live with an open heart and feel that thing that feels right. And when things feel good, follow that thread.
Were you ever afraid of success before you had that big moment?
Yes, there is a big feeling of, and I've come to know a lot of people who are extraordinarily successful, and there's this idea that after you've won your Oscar or your Pulitzer, that, oh man, I wonder if anyone realizes that I'm an imposter. I'm just this kid that really, worked like crazy to try to cobble something together, and I'm not as good as this piece of work that I just happened to find my way into. It feels like when you're successful, it's almost like a bank heist or something, a robbery. You just manage, to do something, because I'm still that kid from Alaska. Mm-hmm. And now I'm in New York, and, and there's a lot of wonderful things happening for my career. So I think the relationship with self-doubt is just a part of and a central aspect of what it is to be human. And when that self-doubt comes up, I think the way to approach it is go, oh, there you are, old friend, and you kind of bow to it and manage, manage your rhythm, and we proceed anyway. And I think that's kind of the amazing, courageous aspect of the human spirit.
For sure. Well, we're out of time, but thank you so much for speaking with me today. It was really wonderful to talk to you.
An absolute pleasure. Thanks for coming to the studio.
Thank you so much for joining us on another episode of Question Everything. I'm your host, Carly Sotis, and each week I bring you inspiration and insights from creative minds and experts in entrepreneurship, publishing, and design.